Welcome. I'm Susie Wiseman, and on tonight's program, we have playwright Murray Mednick and actor Maury Sterling in studio to discuss the play Mayakovsky and Stalin, which is playing at the Lounge Theater, and that's at 6201 Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. It plays Fridays and Saturdays tonight at 8 and Sundays at 3 through August 19th. So there's 5 more shows, and after you hear this, you're going to want to run out and get tickets. And the play is really remarkable, and it's about two distantly related suicides in 1930 and 1932 in the young Soviet Union, that of the giant of Russian poetry, Vladimir Mayakovsky, and 2 years later of Stalin's wife, Nadezhda Aleluyeva. And in many respects, the plays also, I think about the gap between the stated ideals of the revolution and the harsh reality and fear of repression that increasingly dominated the lives of Soviet citizens as Stalin rose to become supreme leader. So we're going to welcome Murray Mednick and Maury Sterling and get their take on the challenges of first presenting this play, writing this play, and for Maury, playing Stalin and characterizing him in what is really an incredible performance. And Murray Mednick is a pioneer of the off and off Broadway movements in the 60s and 70s, a playwright in residence at Theater Genesis. He's also the founding artistic director of the Padua Hills Playwright Workshop from 78 to 95, and he's been richly rewarded with Rockefeller Foundation grants, a Guggenheim Fellowship, American Theater Critics Association Best New Play Citation, and so much more. Maury Sterling, if this was TV and not radio, you'd immediately recognize him and run up and ask him how he does all that surveillance in Homeland, where he plays Matt and actually, you know, inserts himself into a troll farm run by weird forces, right-wing, alt-right forces, let's just say. But he's also known for playing Rafferty in the comedy film Beverly Hills Chihuahua and Lester Tremor in the action film Smoke and Aces. But here we're going to talk about his role as Stalin, which I think he played quite convincingly. So let's just start with some of the themes of the play. And I just maybe wanted to say that the period that's under, you know, examination in this play, it's really like the culmination of the 20s. The revolution takes place in 1917, but after the Civil War, there's this flowering of literature and art.
Just briefly.
Briefly. Well, yeah. I'm going to say before it gets shut down. And then increasingly, it becomes what the writer Max Eastman said, artists in uniform, strangled and suffocated by Soviet socialist realism and everything else. So,
sent away to camp.
It's sent away to all kinds of camps, exactly. So maybe we could just begin with the main themes of the play, Murray, and sort of how you began to explore this sort of...
Well, I think the main thing was the correspondence between the two suicides, and that what brought them together, what brought Stalin and Mayakovsky together was Lily Brick. So I found out about the Brick arrangement, which was a menage a trois. It was a three-sided arrangement which her husband went along with. And the suicide of Mayakovsky, which he was 36 when he shot himself. So it goes on into the mid-30s, I think, and starts before the revolution. The stirrings of the revolution, and then what happened afterward.
And, of course, Mayakovsky had become a convinced Bolshevik by, I think, 1914, and he wrote all these poems that some were highly critical of for being too much focused on industrialization and mechanical sort of things. But others, you know,
well,
clearly
he was interested,
a giant.
Yeah, he was interested in a real revolution of mores and attitudes and lifestyles. And, you know, he was a little out of his mind, actually, with the futurism stuff.
But the other thing I think that you bring it out. And for people outside of the then Soviet Union or Russia after, probably know nothing of Lilia Brick and her husband, Osip, who's this literary critic, and she becomes a muse to the avant-garde poets of her generation. Do you know, like, how did she do that? Do we know?
Well, she was an actress. She was an actress and a performer. Her enthusiasm was sound film.
And one of the people who I attended the play with, who grew up in the Soviet Union, said that the actress was a dead ringer. It was, you know, just
She looked a lot like her,
A lot like her and played her very well. And so maybe we could set the scene a little bit for the listeners about the sort of atmosphere of, you know, opening up in the 20s. Since they opened up, you know, they questioned everything. Alexandra Kollontai famously preached free love and serial monogamy. And I should just say this because I said it all the time to my students. She said, "You make love like you drink a glass of water." And Lenin retorted, "But who wants to drink from a dirty glass?"
Yeah.
And, you know, and that to me sort of encapsulates the kind of, you know, friction.
And delusion.
So go ahead. So, like, how did you decide to put, you know, that relationship at the center?
Well, it's stage-worthy. You know, you have people talking to each other. And the conflicts are right there. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to mess around with them or create them. They occur naturally, biographically, as it were, you know, historically. And the consequences for them were dire. And it's just a natural thing for me to write about, and they're very stage worthy in that a scene could follow a scene without any introduction. You just show the scenes, and you don't need sets, and you don't need a lot of paraphernalia, you don't need props, you just need the characters, and then they kind of step on stage and play their scene.
And I should ask Maury too, who plays Stalin. Like, was this difficult? Because it's not like, you know, an action play in the sense that the action comes from the words, but there's a lot of, I guess, action behind the words. So was this difficult then to portray this character of Stalin?
Yes. Murray doesn't know this, but I was firmly convinced it was never going to happen, and I wasn't going to do it until the last second. And then I realized, oh, man, this is happening. The way we chose to do the play, and sort of I think Murray's vision from the get-go is very specific, and it's heavy on language, which through rehearsal we came to all appreciate more and more. But yes, it puts a lot of pressure on. It was a lot of pressure. I had to bring as much of the character as I could because the scenes are so simple, which means you can't get away with hiding. You really have to have full moments in all this kind of language. So yes, it was a bit terrifying. It was just terrifying to take on Stalin anyways, but, you know, yeah.
Well, all the actors are on stage all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so they're sitting in the back. Like,
in
I think
the back.
There's 9 or 10
right.
chairs.
That was my original vision of the thing, those chairs in the back. Because I've been always troubled by the difficulties of entrances and exits, and always thought there was something cheap about them. You open a door and walk in, blah, 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 or come from the wings. I always wanted to have the actors on stage. And my last play, which was called Villon, about the French poet, I had the actors on the side, and then they would knock on a invisible door and go on stage. There was a bunch of boards that were a stage. So this time I thought I'd have them on stage facing the audience. And it worked in a way that's inexplicable, but it worked beautifully. And all so entering, you stand up. Sitting, to leave, you sit. That's how you make your entrances and exits. And it really worked for me anyway.
And for somebody in the audience, it works as well because, you know, I glanced at them to see if I could find any expressions as, you know, the words were being, you know, said to see if they react, but they don't.
No, they just sit quietly.
Sit quietly, but surely it must inform the way that you speak when you speak.
It does. I think the best part, it took me a while to get unself-conscious, so I've really started to listen to the play more as I sit there, and I'm watching the actors. it's been great. I mean, it's just an enjoyable it's turning out to be an enjoyable thing for me to too when I'm not doing something, just sit there and listen and hear more of the play, more of the parallels between Mayakovsky talking about sacrifice, followed by a scene by Stalin talking about sacrifice, and Nadja talking about the insects of the Soviet sort of Politburo, and then Mayakovsky saying you're all insects, and sort of these neat language parallels. I didn't hear them until, you know, last weekend because I've been so self-absorbed. Yeah. But you know, I hope the audience is getting that.
There's another. I mean, there's so much to explore here, but you have these two suicides, one in 1930 and one in 1932. And they don't really know each other, these characters.
No, they didn't.
And in one sense, you know, I think it's open to discussion about why did Mayakovsky commit suicide? Was that he felt suffocated as a poet, or he was disappointed in love, or he was being constrained artist?
There's no one reason for that kind of thing. Yeah. He was a complicated guy. He was, and a little bit probably past his time, but he was very screwed up. And when you get into it, it makes sense that he commits suicide once you learn a lot about him. You know, his poetry veers from the abstract to the overly lyrical, to mixed metaphors, to just ranting. And he was put down a lot when he was young by students, you know, because they had him reading all over Soviet Union. After the revolution, they had him conducting readings and workshops, like we do here. And they didn't like him much, the students. So there would be these jeering contests. They would jeer at him, and he would jeer back. And meanwhile, he was conducting this affair with various women, including Lily.
But he was actually living with Lily and her husband, right? And
partially. Part-time.
Part-time.
Yeah.
And amazingly, it was no problem for the husband, it seems.
No, but I didn't get into him too deeply. There may be some problems there that I haven't uncovered.
Right. But what's interesting, too, is that at this time in the 20s, there's this vibrant discussion going on about the relationship of literature and revolution and the role of the artist. And it's kind of like a heavy burden in one sense, I would think, for the poet to kind of express the devotion for the revolution and the ideals, and on the other hand, as that power play goes on in the 30s and Stalin comes out on top and then really starts to crush any form of resistance, to feel the suffocation of that.
Mayakovsky felt it before that. He right after, by 1920, I would say, I'm just guessing really, he was sick of the revolution, and he knew it was full of baloney. You know, he saw people coming home without arms and legs, and, you know, he wasn't...
out of the Civil War.
He wasn't crazy about that revolution to begin with.
Yeah, it doesn't come out in his poems, I would say, part.
He wanted to sound right.
But on the other hand, when he committed suicide, and the other great poet, Yesenin, did before that, I think in 26...
There were quite a few.
It was a signpost for the revolution.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think Victor Serge famously said, when the poets start committing suicide, you know the revolution's in trouble.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, so true. So, okay, then how we'll get into Stalin and the relationship first to literature, because it's Lilia Brick who kind of connects these two stories, right? When she writes to Stalin in 1935 and says, how could Mayakovsky be eliminated from the pantheon? Something like that, right?
Right.
And then he corrects the mistake.
Yeah, he probably never read him, you know.
Right. And then afterwards it became obligatory reading because Stalin said so.
Yeah, because he was part of the Soviet canon.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, so then we get to Stalin's young wife, Nadia, in this play, Nadezhda, who is increasingly filled with despair. And you have all sorts of stuff going on, like including her... Is it her assistant /
housekeeper,
Masha,
yeah, housekeeper,
who's religious?
Yes.
And then, you know, you have... I loved, actually, this part. I think, you know, some lefties might not like so much
They don't like the religious
interjecting
part.
Religion into it. But there was, especially, I think, after that liberatory period when workers felt they were in command of their society and then less and less so, this kind of spiritual void is you, Maury, so, you know, I think you do this almost perfectly in having Stalin's speeches, you know, doing this rote dogmatic ideology, which everybody knows is a harsh contrast with reality, and it's empty, and it's spiritually empty, too.
Thank you for
that. Except for communism. It wasn't empty for him in terms of communism.
For
he
Stalin.
He believed in it.
Yeah.
That was one of the things, sorry to interject, but one of the things that attracted me to Stalin was his devotion to the party. It was single-minded. It was the one thing that he really cared about. And if you messed around with him, then you were really in trouble. And that side of Stalin is not very well, except for communists, it's not very well respected. But that's a real quality of Stalin that kept him all the way to a natural death. He died as an old man from old man diseases because he understood power. And he understood what the power was for. It was for this idea he had about Marxist-Leninism. And he kept to it through his whole life, doggedly.
But I would say he subverted the very essence of it, and that it's finally now.
Well, he wouldn't agree with you about that.
I would be killed if I were there. There's just no doubt.
Well, you might have had a chance to argue with him first.
I would have said he was, you know, he... Because the essence of socialism and communism, as Marx thought, was democracy, that workers themselves, peasants themselves, all of them
right.
would determine the society.
Right.
So just on the party part, you're absolutely right. And I would say that party patriotism did them in, because the party above everything
well,
else,
they thought
the truth
there was
from
something,
the party.
They thought there was something subsequent to the party.
Yeah, but...
Which was the worker state. And after the worker state, there would be no employer-employees situation. You know, they had it worked out pretty well.
I think one of the things that came up for me in playing Stalin in terms of all the big idea stuff is more a little bit of a, and, you know, argue with me on this one, but is this idea, we get into these kind of political identities and religious identities of these ideas, and ultimately in a way it's rooted, if there was a concept, it's survivalism. You know, he was a street urchin, he was beaten, he grew up with a horrible father in poverty, he grew up on the streets, he was a thug, he was a brigand, he was a Marxist, he was religious for a moment, but then that didn't work, maybe in the face of the sort of conditions of his culture. And in a way, we take, and this is what I love about the play, is it's the power of the idea.
The belief.
And all of these people are taking a belief that they think is going to get them through. Mayakovsky, there's some great lines about Mayakovsky, as you guys are discussing, of sort of this the relationship of a desire to change and no change that we all see. And I think we're in that moment right now. I want these things to – I feel threatened, so stay the same. These things aren't working. We need change. Sort of massive upheaval, but at the same time, you then you reach back for that thing you know. And Stalin feels he's a survivalist. You know, give him a – in the sense of he was going to do what he needed to do to exist. If you got – one book I read said, you know, if you got too close to him, he killed you.
Right.
Because he felt in trouble because he's vulnerable. So get rid of him.
He always said, if there's a person, there's a problem. No person, no problem.
No problem.
Voila.
Yeah, well, I mean, there you
so
go.
Do you think it's your ideal person in the audience is someone who knows something about this or who just comes completely fresh?
Ideally, it would be someone who understands something about theater.
Something about theater.
And,
right.
and what theater can do best.
Yeah. Well, I think you guys
speech.
Pull it off amazingly.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I hope that this play, you know, goes around the country and opens in New York. I think it's amazing that you were able to do this in Los Angeles, right in Hollywood. There are 5 more performances. So for you, the listeners, if you're listening to this, like, I don't know, in Europe or New York, you're out of luck. But but if you're in Los Angeles, you can go to the Lounge Theater on Santa Monica Boulevard through the 19th of August, and it's Friday and Saturday nights at 8, Sundays at 3.
And we're dark next Friday the 17th. We don't have a show, so yes.
Okay, so right. Saturday and Sunday. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
In studio, it's been a great pleasure, and I think we could probably go on a lot longer talking about this. But I'm very pleased to have had. Did you want to say one more thing?
No, they were just, very interesting people to try and deal with.
And also, let's just very finally say, it must be hard to deal with somebody who has this, who's like the mass murderer of the 20th century.
Well, Hitler had him beat.
I'm not sure, actually. So sure. That's debatable, but the point was like to play somebody who, you know, how can you like him?
Yeah.
But that's the thing. That's really the thing. There has to be something likable about him. There has to be. It's human.
That's what's terrifying.
Thank you so much. And I think we'll end it there. Maury Sterling, who plays Stalin in Mayakovsky and Stalin, and who you will recognize as Max in Homeland and many other things. Emery Mednick, the award-winning playwright, founder, director of the Padua Playwright
System. Padua Hills Playwrights Workshop.
Thank you. And the play is at the Lounge Theater in Santa Monica right now. And I'm Susie Wiseman. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank you.